Hello and welcome to Series 3, Episode 5 of Old Brother, a podcast about Salford / Manchester's legendary musical institution, The Fall. As you know by now, each week we've invited our guests to chat about their experiences and memories of the group. You can find us at Spotify, Apple and all the usual suspects, but we're actually hosted at play.acast.com/s/Old Brother. All episodes are also available on YouTube. Search for Old Brother Podcast and subscribe so you'll never miss an episode. This week, we're joined by Mr. Dave Aslam, all the way from Paris, thanks to the wonders of modern technology. Hope you enjoy it. Hello, here we are, the latest edition of Old Brother, the Fall podcast with me, Paul Hanley, and my elder brother, Stephen. Good evening, Stephen.
Good evening.
You well?
I'm okay, thanks, yeah. Got all my technical glitches there, but...
Yeah. Hey, don't shine daylight on the magic. It works perfectly every time. So, our guest today probably needs no introduction, but I mean, I'm going to have to introduce him because otherwise he won't know who he is. So we're delighted to be speaking today to journalist, author, DJ and serial appearer on programmes about the Hacienda, Mr. David Haslam. Good afternoon, David.
Good day. How are you doing?
Okay, thanks, you.
Yeah, I am so bored of appearing on programmes about the Hacienda.
I wonder if Pete Hux is thinking that.
He won't be, no, and neither will Noel Gallagher. He's got a new house music.
But apparently he lost some money, did he?
Pete Hux, apparently.
He
lost some money, did he?
He keeps it, to talk about it.
Keeps it very quiet. I only do them because I like to take the opportunity to slag off Thatcher about the 80s. And I don't think that anyone else will. Hookie probably won't. But so I say yes, just as long as I can talk politics.
Right. And did you win that one last night?
Yeah, I managed to get Thatcher into the conversation.
Oh, okay. Yeah. In between bouncing off the walls next to Pete Waterman, he did a bit of politics, yeah.
Yeah, a bit of politics.
Oh yeah.
I we won't spend the whole time talking about Hacienda, but I tell you who's always absent. I mean, oh God rest his soul, he can't be a peer, but Claude never gets enough of a.
I thought there was a massive hole between it starting and it being empty, to then all the acid house stuff. But they had some amazing gigs on, didn't they?
Yeah, I mean, the fact they had William Burroughs doing a reading, I don't know if either of you were there, Psychic TV supported by William Burroughs. I mean, that's a bit of a mad one in a warehouse in Manchester.
I just remember the Cramps and the birthday party. And
absolutely.
Thunders as well. Mark Riley and the Creepers supported Johnny Thunders at the Ascend. That was a great gig as well.
Curtis Mayfield. Whoa.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
It was empty. Then Madonna appears, and then it suddenly turns into acid house.
They only give an hour for these documentaries, don't they? And I guess, peak time BBC. They tell the basic story, but that's what you get with music history, isn't it? You find people just latch on to two or three things. Oh, yeah, The Fall. Oh, yeah, Marquis Smith used to sack loads
of people. Had a lot of members.
And that's like the only thing that people say all the time, like it's an original thought.
Yes. Tell you what's a good one. Always different, always the same. I could do that quote a few more times.
I know. So, normally I do these interviews for the Hacienda and they edit everything out that I've said that I think is interesting and all they leave in is, we were mad for it. quoted in a few documentaries and all my beautifully articulated thought on the politics and culture of the moment is edited out. I'd say we were mad for it.
Did you come up with that phrase, Dave?
No, and also I wasn't really mad for it. Do you know what I mean? I was working hard behind the DJ.
Indeed. Yeah. So when we can't spend the whole time talking about the Ascender. We'll get back to it. We'll tell you what we'll do. We'll go back to the mist through the mists of time to 1980, which I believe is when you started at uni. Is that were you at uni or the poly?
At the uni, yeah. That's when I moved up from Birmingham to come up to Manchester to study.
What were you studying?
English. I didn't really know much about the course. I just wanted to be I mean, also, to be honest, Birmingham and Manchester and Liverpool, Leeds, all those places were pretty similar in many ways, post-industrial. Yeah. Birmingham had had a great music scene, and I, as a teenager, I'd seen, you know, the Au Pairs and Dexys and the Prefects. Mm-hmm. I think I saw their final gig, Steel Pulse. So there was a good scene around, but the Manchester stuff, Buzzcocks, Full Magazine, I feel like I just wanted to be in the same city as that. I don't remember studying what I was going to be reading on the course at the uni or whatever. I just wanted to be somewhere that was exciting and musical. So,
right. Because the uni then was like the hub of the Manchester music scene in a lot of ways, wasn't it? I mean, between the uni and the poly.
There were a lot of college gigs, weren't there, around that?
Yeah.
I mean, the poly, the uni, I think I saw Jonathan Richman, Altered Images, you know, just in my first couple of months there. And the poly in the old Cavendish building.
That was a great venue,
It was a great venue.
And I saw The Cure there, and I think that was the first place I saw The Fall.
Yes, that was. I'll look up the date while we're talking, but that was at the Poly. And the one they always say about that one is when Mark leapt into the audience to smack somebody for throwing something at him.
I asked Mark about that 31 years later, and he had no recollection of it whatsoever. But that was what interviewing Mark was like. Do you know what I mean? It wasn't easy, let's be honest. But
I was going to say that I've watched by way of research for this. I listened to and read the transcripts of you interviewing Mark just after his autobiography came out, and you keep asking him about stuff that's in the book. He keeps saying, "What are you talking about? I've never heard that story before in my life." He's in your bleeding autobiography.
And I think at one point he says, that ghostwriter's got a lot to answer for.
that poor bloke.
He had a job, didn't he? I'm sure. Yeah.
I think he did. I mean, Mick Middles did a Mark book as well, didn't he? Which I think that was just riddled with inaccuracies, unfortunately. I think the one that Austin Collins ghosted was a lot better, but yeah, Mark was denying lots of stuff in that when I interviewed him.
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing with the Austin Collins, I didn't say Austin Powers then, Austin Collins one was, he kind of set the parameters whereby there's no way we're getting a proper autobiography out of this, so I might as well just make it be sat next to Mark in the pub, really.
Sat next to Mark, talking. Yeah. It did read just like having a conversation with him, yeah.
Yeah. So, I don't know if anyone can independently corroborate whether Mark got off the stage to hit somebody, but I mean, obviously it's the sort of thing you do remember when you're a punter down the front.
Yeah. I think seem to remember it, because there was always that. I don't know. There was always that sort of thing. Do we go and help him, or do we? What do we keep playing? Do we stop playing? And then sort of round then, because I'd really only just joined, and he said, "Keep playing, just keep playing. Anything like that happens, just keep playing."
I don't know what the confrontation was all about, but I mean, as far as me having already built up The Fall in my head, you know, before seeing them, it was exactly what I wanted to see. and that edge at gigs was, I thought that just added to it all, you know, and I've said it many times about the bands that I like that to see live. I mean, I remember when I saw Joy Division, they were kind of, you know, they didn't sound as like they did on the record.
And
then later when Happy Mondays came along, and it would all look like they were all playing different songs and the whole thing's going to fall apart. And I like that. I never want to go and see a live act where they just sound like they do on the record and it's all lovely and slick. And that's one of the things that I liked about The Fall. But you did, although, you know, I mean, it's not like it was about to fall apart, but it was more the edge, I think.
Yeah, that's definitely it. I mean, it's harder to do than you think, actually, because there's nothing worse than it actually falling apart, is there?
Yeah.
I mean, that's just awful. That's a bloody racket. But if you can walk that kind of line, it takes some doing, but and it takes, you know, it takes people with profoundly poor musical skills like me and my brother there. But you don't want to get too good, do you? But then you don't want to be deliberately not good. So, I mean, it's kind of, you know, it's kind of like magic, really, isn't it? So, yeah, anyhow, Dave, it was the 1st of November, 1980.
Right.
And it says here, there's a quote here. It says, my favourite Fall moment from the very first time I saw them at Manchester Poly in 1980. Someone in the crowd lobbed a beer can up and hit Mark E. Smith with it. Mark didn't blink an eye, carried on the song without pausing. At the end of the song, he went over to Anlie and Scanlon, who pointed out somebody in the crowd about halfway back. Mark E. Smith shouts, you fucking ugly twat, walks off the stage and reappears a minute later.
Where's that? That's somebody else's memory.
This is the Fall. I mean, it's an invaluable, it's a Fall gigography. Yeah. So basically,
wonderful.
List of every gig, near enough.
It's always nice, isn't it, to get your memories confirmed, because we are at that age where we do
I'm looking at this. Played the Poly about five times that year.
And I mean, I think that was around the time of I think The Man Whose Head Expanded was my favourite Fall record at that time, and I think that was
you're way out there. That's 2 years later.
Yeah.
Now.
Yeah. Right, when was Grotesque?
Grotesque was then. That was when that was.
Ah, Grotesque, yeah. Yes. That was New Face in Hell, I think, was one of my favourite Fall records. That's right,
good man. You can stay. You can stay the hour now, Dave. You've said that.
Going with Man Whose Head Expanded.
90% of them. I tell you when they were great. This Nation's Saving is great. Oh, yeah, you mean 5 minutes after I left? Yeah, that's when they were at the
best. But I think Grotesque was the first album I bought by the Fall. I mean, I wasn't a big album buyer anyway, but... I remember is it like a kazoo or something in New Face in Hell?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if, just that kind of unpredictability. What always just still pisses me off is the way that Smith still gets portrayed. Again, we were talking earlier, weren't we, about how simplified everything is, you know, as a pisshead, basically.
Yeah.
And all as a bunch of northern oiks. And it just pisses me off so much, because the amount of kind of artistic creativity and credibility in those sort of records and just generally was, you know, immense. And if that kind of music would be made by somebody in New York, you know, we'd be kind of talking about them in a totally different way, you know, my high hope.
How much of that was of his own doing, though? Because I think he definitely had a, you know, there's no reason why. He wasn't, like you say, he gets portrayed as a pisshead, but he's clearly a very intelligent bloke with a very intelligent line of thinking.
Yeah.
And a lot of the interviews, he's running it a lot of the time, do you not think? Where it's... You know, he had the thing that he did in interviews, and people couldn't cope with it. I don't know.
I don't. I mean, to be honest, I don't know how many times I interviewed him. I think I did two public ones and about five or six, you know, for newspapers. Mm-hmm. And he'd had, you know, lots to drink or whether he hadn't, he was still a very difficult interview. I used to think, if I could just manipulate the situation so we just sit down and have a cup of tea together, I'll get like a totally different Mark. And that isn't how it ever worked.
That never happened then, did it?
No. And so I think it was just the way that his almost his default position being interviewed was to be a bit belligerent. But that wasn't, I don't think, out of the fact that he was drunk and out of control, because it didn't make any difference how drunk he was.
No.
That was just how he was. So...
It might have made for difficult I'm, there's no might about it. I'm sure it did make for very difficult, your job difficult as when you're interviewing, but that doesn't necessarily translate as making it a bad article. They're always good articles, aren't they?
Oh, yeah. I mean, he was, as they say, he was great copy. You know what I mean? Yeah. I used to love interviewing him, you know, and when I interviewed him live in front of an audience, I loved it even more because I knew it would be a circus. I knew it would be so memorable. And if people have paid, you know, a tenner to see two old men chatting about stuff on the stage, then it has to be a degree of kind of entertainment. And also that edge that the Fall had live, you know, and even though he used to make it difficult, he used to take the piss out of me relentlessly in interviews, it didn't really matter to me. It was water off a duck's back. And I always ended up thinking, well, at least he hasn't bitten my ear off. Or, you know.
literally bit your ear off.
Quite a low bar in terms of was that a successful interview. But it could be a bit like that, couldn't it?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we said that this come up a few times now, but I think he thought it was part of his job, really, to
have also, the interview. And also, he used to think that all journalists had expense accounts. So I do think also, if you read the interviews, a lot of the interviews, you know, I think Smith used to like taking advantage of NME writers coming up from London. In fact, I remember one time I interviewed him for City Life magazine, 1986, just before GMEX, the Festival of the Town Summer gig. And he was really insistent that he needed pizza. And so me and Mark went to that pizza restaurant near the Shakespeare pub.
Oh, yeah.
I can't remember what it was called now.
Pizza Land in them days, I think?
No, it was one of those that was called like Giovanni's or Luciano. We wouldn't have gone to. Anyway, that's why. Yeah, and he made me pay for it, even though I wasn't on. Had an expense account. He thought he wanted to get something out of the interview.
Quite right.
He was like, "You're paying for this." I'm like, "Oh, well, okay." I can't, for the Fall fans who'd like to know what toppings he had, I'm afraid I don't remember.
Ah, you flipped us down there, Dave. Yeah. We might as well stop it now.
Probably not a lot, I'd say.
No. But I know the other Fall gig, which I wanted to mention to you guys, was the one at Fagin's, where I believe, Paul, it was your first night with two drummers.
It was. That's right, yeah. I think I'm right in saying the Distractions supported, I think. Was it the Distractions or had they changed? Didn't we call something else after the Distractions? I can't remember.
I don't remember it being the Distractions. I don't know. Mm. But I just absolutely loved that gig. I think that was probably my favourite Fall gig and definitely that kind of, the extra... whatever, hard driving rhythm of you and Carl was just.
Yeah, I mean, it was brilliant. It was quite a thing that, because it was. I mean, I know Adam and the Ants did it, but it was the whole two drummer things was quite. Well, quite the revolutionary, band. I think.
Didn't the Glitter Band do it as well?
The Glitter Band did it, yeah, but. Yeah. I'm talking about, you know, your post punk.
Yeah.
That was, here's my very good friend, the Fall Gigography. That was the 30th of September, 1981. That
All right, okay.
Yeah, and it doesn't say he was supporting. Never mind.
What was Carl like as a co-drummer, Paul?
I was going to say you knew him pretty well, didn't you? Got to know him pretty well, Carl.
Me?
Yeah.
Oh,
I don't know. Am I wrong about that?
Well, I don't know. Did he?
Yes.
He got that information from. I just remember him. He used to come to some of the gigs that I used to do, like in kind of 84.
He lived in the Hacienda, didn't he?
Yeah, but also I did a night at what was called the Venue.
I remember the Venue.
And he used to come in the Venue. And I mean, oftentimes there was a bit of an aura around him which was a little bit negative.
He
wasn't like Mr. It wasn't like, oh, he's going to be a great asset to the party. But that's kind of what prompted my question about what he was like to kind of be.
He was a bit of a hero of mine, drumming wise, before, because you know I always say, like, when I was 14, there was John Marr, Carl, and Steve Morris were all like, literally within touching distance sometimes, because the old used to rehearse in the same place. I used to go and watch them. So they were all like, I was massively in awe of all three of them, really. And then so it was a bit weird, really, because A, he was pinching my drum stool, and B, he was one of my drumming heroes. And then to get the chance to play with him, it was kind of a bit of a two-edged sword, really, because on one point I could have said, well, actually, I'm the drummer, this isn't right. But on the other hand, to get the opportunity to do that with Carl was just brilliant, and it was one of the best things I've ever done, playing two drums with Carl. It was, well, playing two drums is an amazing thing to do anyway, and I've not really done it enough, but I think we did it pretty well, I think.
Yeah, you did. He certainly was a great, I mean, you know, I don't mean to denigrate him at all. He was a fantastic drummer. You know, I just kind of knew the kind of crew that he hung out with when he wasn't hanging out with you guys.
No, nobody ever gives a thought to the poor old bass player, though, do they, who's got to play with two drummers?
No, I don't even know what a bass player does, to be honest, Steve.
He stands near the drummer, basically.
That's all quite tricky, you know.
Is it? I've never asked you about that, Steve. Was it more difficult being a bass player with two
drummers? Remember it. No, I don't remember it being sort of any more difficult.
Or any
I'd have thought it would have been easier because I dislike the blast so much. It's not like you're not going to be able to hear them.
Well, I mean, to an extent, he took a bit of yours as well. He did a bit of second bass as well, didn't he, Carl?
He did a second bass on the
cut. Wow. On both of our toes. Right.
there is the old story, but no.
What? We can cut it out if it's controversial.
No, just, you know, by the time he'd got off his kit, got the bass on, found his plectrum, sorted the amp out, the song was nearly over.
That's why all his bits are at the back end of the song.
Yeah, Scamp said that, didn't he? It's quite funny.
Very true.
What did the band make of it when Mark started messing around with amps and telling people?
We have kind of covered that in this, but I didn't like it at all.
No, okay. Right, that's fine.
No.
Well, who did like it? I think.
I know.
Later on, they didn't mind it, did they, so much?
No.
Elaine always saw it as we were talking about it. She saw it quite as a positive thing, you know, on stage mixing or whatever it was termed. But it seems a bit hit and miss way of mixing for me, moving the microphone.
Well, doesn't it?
Yeah. Well, there's a Bernard. Occasionally wanders over to where Gillian in New Order's with her keyboard and messes a little bit with that as well.
I saw that. There was a big debate, like whether she was all right with it or not. Is it the end of one of the songs? He sort of pushes her out the way, doesn't he, and starts pissing about on her keyboard.
I'll ask her and I'll report back.
Yes, please do. Please do. We won't get it on tape, though. She can say, if she wants to say it confidentially, that's fine. So have you seen them lately, New Order?
No. I mean, I would have loved to have gone to watch them with the Pet Shop Boys in America.
Yeah.
But I got involved, it seems like only yesterday, but I think it was 2017 when they did the synthesizer orchestra for the Manchester International Festival.
Oh, yeah.
That was something that I co-curated, which was an amazing experience. Yeah, so top people.
So, indeed. So who did you get? Who got you in the divorce then? You, them or Ookie?
Oh, well, yeah. I'm Team Bernard, and I'm comfortable with my choice.
Okay, cool. That's another loaded sentence.
Very diplomatic.
it's a pretty sad state of affairs, but it is,
isn't it?
You know?
Yeah.
So,
Because what I was going to say about New Order is, because, you know, we all have seen them fairly early on. I've seen the light. And they are very good. And so are New Order now. But they're a bit muscular for me now. One of the things I always liked about them was early, like you say, that kind of, it looked like all the equipment was going to fail at any minute and the whole thing was going to fall apart when they first started.
Yeah.
And they were like very tenuous, weren't they? Which was great, I thought. I thought that was fun. I mean, I suppose it's difficult to keep going with that when they're playing the kind of venues they are now. You don't want it to be like, oh no, the DAC machine's broke down again or whatever. You want to be some kind of consistency. But yeah. I think that's a shame in a way, because they were one of those bands that were really good at that. So, you go and see them sometimes and they play for like 25 minutes.
Mm. Oh, yeah. Which obviously, when they started doing encores, that was a big moment. but I think people had different opinions about the 25, 30-minute sets. I think, I think people always wanted a lot more from them anyway,
there's that whole thing with gigs now, isn't there? You know, I mean, looking at the price, I mean, I hate to sound like an old fart, but you look at the prices on gigs now.
Yeah.
And you think,
it must be difficult. I was talking to someone the other day about who's going to go and see The Cure.
Mm-hmm.
And, she said, have you ever seen The Cure? And I said, well, I have, but not since 1980 or something. And, they were like, a punky group. I think the first time I saw them, they were 3-piece. But
yes.
And now they do like 2.5-hour sets, don't they? But it must be hard in a way. That's great because they've got a load of material, but it must be so very different to them as people and musicians, over 40 years later. And in a way, you wouldn't want them to be the same. You want it to kind of evolve.
Which is the striking thing about The Fall, really. The fact that they were still a kind of fragile, what the hell's going to happen kind of band 41 years on, weren't they? I mean, that takes some doing that. I mean, and I don't think all the choices were particularly healthy ones or popular ones that Mark made to keep that like that. But, we've had this conversation. You've got to say, in the end of the day, for him to pull it off, it's quite amazing, and it is completely unique, I think.
Yeah, but at the same time, I mean, I think I like the way that the Fall moved on, and Mark. I mean, one of the things he kept was frustrating in interviews is obviously as a journalist and a fan, you want to talk about stuff, but if I talked to him about two drummers, he'd be like, oh well, that was a long time ago, and can we talk about the new album? And then I talk about the new album, and he's like, well, I want to talk about the next album, And I remember doing one interview, with him, and he got really narky because I wasn't moving on quickly to talk about the band. And as you know, he always used to think that the current lineup were the best lineup.
Yes.
So that was like always something that he said. But it was, for him, it was, very much about the now, and not kind of looking back nostalgically. And I always really admired him for that.
Yeah, me too. Because even, you look at The Cure, they're still making records. I'm not picking on The Cure particularly or New World or anything, but there's a sop to new stuff, and, there's maybe 3-ish songs a night, whereas The Fall, it was just right at the end, you go and see The Fall, and
the recent material,
if you got one off the last album, which is incredible, really. It's a lot of work. It would have been a lot easier for him to just, get four lads who could play Mr. Yeah. Pharmacist properly and just, and just do that. But
that's kind of what the Buzzcocks did eventually. Yeah. They did their set, and that was their, and it was an old, old tunes, but well played.
Yeah. I fully understand that, I can fully see that that's a way to go, it's what's striking is that The Fall never did that rather than the other way around. I mean, it seems like a fairly logical thing for me, because the people who go in a lot of the time don't want to hear your new album, do they?
Yeah, I mean, a very brave thing to do. I mean, I kept on, you know, going to see the Fall when I could. And
did you see them later on then?
Yeah, but not in the last 2 years. But again, it would be one of those where I remember seeing them one time, and it was really actually quite depressing because, you know, it was like a cheap PA, and there was no kind of energy about it. And then I sort of saw a year later, and it was absolutely amazing, you know. But I think that's probably the general Fall experience. Yeah. Blindness is still one of my favorite ever Fall tracks.
Yeah.
I mean, I think there was, you know, a lot of great stuff late on, or relatively late on anyway.
Mm-hmm. No, definitely. I think that last. I mean, that's the other thing. That last lineup lasted 10 years, didn't it? No, near enough.
Yeah.
And so they, because that whole, again, it's the old Granny on Bongos bollocks, whereby people, you can't just put it down to, well, obviously they're going to sound different, or obviously they're going to, because it's a new member. I think they did that anyway, you know.
Yeah. So just the other thing I wanted to. Say, because I don't know if either of you have been lucky enough to read Sonic Youth Slept on My Floor, my acclaimed memoir.
Oh, I can't remember the guy who wrote that. What was his name?
Who was it? And it wasn't a ghostwriter either. there's a few Fall stories in there, a few Mark stories.
Oh yeah,
and one of them which. Occasionally, you know, well, obviously you guys know when you've got a book out, you go and do some readings.
Yeah.
There was one particular Mark Eastman story which always went down really well. And seeing as you don't know it, I can tell you it now, which was...
How do you know?
How do you know we don't know it?
Oh, sorry. Well, if you've not read the book, you won't know it.
I have read the book. Anyway, go on. I digress. Go on.
Mark E. Smith at My Wedding. Have you read that bit? You remember that bit? So when I got married... I invited Mark to the wedding and, well, the party after, which was it is what it sounds like, which was, it was called The Shed, basically, in Fallowfield. cheap, basically.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was on two floors, and the downstairs bit was kind of like slightly older people, and then upstairs was basically full-on rave. Reflecting
which room were you in, Dave?
Well, yeah, reflecting the two parts of my personality. And so Mark was I think he was with Caroline, his sister, and he started off downstairs, which but then he positioned himself at the stairs, and he sort of began to kind of pull at people and sort of slightly bother people as they were going up and downstairs. And I had a neighbor who was about 15 years older than me, and Mark was convinced he was my dad. he pissed him off. And anyway, word came, Dave, Mark's bothering people, and a few people were finding it a bit intimidating. So will you go and have a word? Okay, so strategy required at that point, because obviously I wasn't going to kind of square up to him because I'd invited him to my wedding. He's my pal. So I grabbed him and I said, Mark, come and dance. And I took him upstairs to the rave room, and me and him hit the dance floor. And obviously, as we appeared, people kind of cleared the dance floor a little bit, like, you know, the parting of the way, Moses. And the DJ played this song, it's called Plastic Dreams. It's like a Belgian techno record.
Of course it is. Of course it's like a Belgian techno record.
And it's, and we started dancing together, me and Mark. And, he was in his suit and everything. And I don't know whether you can recall many times when you saw Mark dancing to Belgian techno, but he had moves.
Yeah, he was a good dancer, Mark. He used to do a bit on stage early on. It was always a good dancer.
Yeah, but he,
I think Jarvis Cocker built his whole career on Mark's early dance moves.
Yeah, he was, and it was a lot more than just kind of swaying. You know, it was like he knew what he was doing. But then he started, he kind of leant forward and started kind of freestyle rapping into my ear. and just like nonsense stuff. I think I don't know why he did that. I mean, again, maybe he wanted to bite my ear off and he couldn't quite bring himself.
your ears have survived here, haven't they?
So there I was, and I was thinking, you know, and obviously in those sort of moments, your brain is whirring, and I'm like, I never thought I was going to spend my wedding dancing with Mark.
Funny, it was a tape of that. You could have made a new fall album there, Belgian Techno, with Mark freestyle rapping over the song.
I was praying that the DJ was playing like that, you know, wasn't playing the extended 15-minute mix. I don't know if this is
you know what they like, them DJs, Dave? They, you know, anything for an easy life. You stick one of them on.
So when was the divorce then, Dave?
To be honest, it was.
You invited Mark Smith to our wedding.
And it was such a funny moment. I think we sort of stayed. I don't know what the DJ played next, but we kind of, I think a few people joined us on the dance floor, and it was a lot of fun. I spoke to Caroline the other day, and I speak to her quite a lot, and she's fine. She's good. I mean, obviously, there's a few bits and bobs coming up for sale in various auctions. Mm. Uh-huh. So we were talking about that, and obviously, you know, he was devoted to his sisters and his wife. And they were devoted to him, you know, and so it's, you know, obviously difficult, still a very difficult situation for all of them.
Sadly, the last time we saw Caroline Paul was at the Pete Shelley thing, wasn't it?
Yeah, who was that guy interviewed?
Oh, yeah.
I know, Caroline, if she listens to this, won't mind me reminding her of the question that she asked from the audience of Pete, which was, what would his funeral song be?
Oh, yes, of course.
And that was literally the last interview that Pete Shelley ever did.
That was a great interview, that. I mean, you know.
It was.
It's on YouTube, if any.
I've seen it about 50 times.
Really good interview. And
there's a great question from somebody at the end as well. I can't remember who that was. Somebody from the audience.
Who was that? Loud mouth.
Modesty forbids me.
What was your question?
I can't remember. It was about... I know what it was. I asked him, which did he think was more culturally important? Putting the Sex Pistols on at the Lesser Free Trade Hall or releasing Spiral Scratch? That was
good question.
Very good.
Yeah. I was trying to redeem myself for shouting "fuck him" when you mentioned Morrissey.
he was talking about Morrissey, wasn't he?
Yeah.
He didn't hold back. So
good.
That's what I mean. Those on-stage interviews, you know, because they're in front of an audience. I think as an interviewer, you kind of feel empowered somehow to ask even difficult questions.
Yes.
In a way, the audience want you to. They don't want just the kind of the Wikipedia stuff. You know, they want you to maybe go into slightly dangerous territory.
Mm. That's true. I think that's true of a lot of music journalism now, or anything. Mm. The day of facts and figures are gone, aren't they? I mean, people can look that up for themselves, can't they?
Yeah, yeah. All that stuff about, you know, when did you form and all that kind of
strings.
you don't need to ask that kind of stuff anymore. The first interview I did with Mark on stage, in fact, it was at the Green Room, which is now Gorilla.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
When was it? 2011. It was Mark. Mark brought his mum. There was in many of my encounters with him, obviously I didn't work with him in the same way. And I know that when you're in a very intense situation with people, all kinds of fallings out can happen, which is, you know, my experience mm-hmm. at the end, really. But my experience of a lot of my encounters with Mark was how sweet he could be. And I know that sounds almost like he would have hated me saying that, because it slightly mm-hmm. goes against the grain, but you know, he brought his mum to the show, and we had all kinds of shenanigans. I had to take the smoke alarm. I had to disable a smoke alarm in the dressing room for him.
Okay.
And he got very refreshed before going on stage. But then at the end, and it was pretty difficult, because like you were saying, he kept denying that he'd ever done stuff that he'd written about in his autobiography and make him a life difficult. But at the end, he just said to me, we were backstage again, and he just said to me, was that all right? And I'm like, yeah, that was great, Mark. And I gave him, you know, I gave him his money in a mm-hmm. you know, cash in a brown envelope. And he took 20 quid out, and he just put it on the table next to me and said, you did a great job.
Uh-huh.
And it was a bit like, you know, when your granddad used to give you money at Christmas, yeah. or you go around to visit your grandparents or whatever, and your granddad had slipped you a pound note or something. It was a bit, it felt to me like a very kind of him saying something, do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of moving, that, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, he wouldn't have articulated, you know, he wouldn't have said, oh, you know, you're a good guy or anything. Perish well, the soul. But yeah. Just wanting to kind of mark that moment that we'd kind of done all that together, and, you know, I'd paid him, we'd been a bit of a pal. That was really moving and really emotional. And then he went to fetch his mother and my wife and my daughter came backstage, and you know, that was a lovely moment. And it was partly
my wife had to go at him for ruining a wedding.
Yeah, yeah. Partly because it was so different to the guy who went off stage at the Poly and, you know, had a battle with
mm-hmm. him. But well, to be fair, if someone throws a can and it hits you in the face, I think you've pretty much got every right to go into the haunted lamp, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah. Definitely.
I mean, I don't know if you remember, but when we've talked about this before, that horrible time. They were, when you were being hailed with all kinds of gob and people
spitting at you and throwing
stuff. It's like, how do you show your appreciation for this band? Well, basically, we tell them to fuck off and throw beer at them and spit at them, basically.
Oh, I couldn't have stood that. I mean, occasionally people have thrown stuff at me while I've been DJing. And we had to build a bit of a cage at the boardwalk when I did the boardwalk. We built a cage for the DJ box. But that was I don't know. I mean, they put on gigs there as well, so it could generally get quite rowdy. But I had someone stubbed a cigarette out on my forehead while I was DJing, which was
bloody
quite
hell.
Unexpected. I don't think they were showing any appreciation for the music.
No, I don't think that was a mark of affection, was it? Did the Fall ever play the boardwalk, Sue?
Say again?
Did the Fall ever play the boardwalk?
No,
I don't think we...
No.
We didn't play the boardwalk, no. We used to rehearse there, of course.
Yeah.
I think we were one of the first bands to rehearse there. He used to let us use the room while it was being converted.
Right, yeah, yeah. Okay. It was, again, weirdly enough, it was originally the first venue where the green room were, and when it first opened, it had the whatever it's called chairs, you know, on a kind of angle. So in the refurb, all that had to come out.
What do you mean by that? Chairs on an angle? What does that mean?
Yeah, you know what I mean, like raked seating, they call it.
Oh, right, okay, yes.
Yeah, the board had raked seating because it was a theatre.
Was it?
The main room, yeah. And then I think it was in the 70s, mid-70s.
I always thought that was just like a warehouse, you know, like Davidson's, which we talked about, which was just like sort of next door, wasn't it?
Yeah,
the road, No, well, originally it was the Bordeaux was a Sunday school, a school connected to St. Peter's Church. St. Peter's Church was on St. Peter's Square, where the library was.
Well, that's Little Peter Street, isn't it, I suppose?
Yeah, so. And it was called Little Peter Street because the church Sunday school was there.
That is quite a street with quite a story, isn't it, if you think about it?
Yeah.
Everyone must have walked that street band-wise.
I mean, anyone listening who doesn't know, it's around the corner from where the Hacienda big.
Well, that is it. You're in your rehearsal room, and then you've got your boardwalk, and your holy grail is getting to the Hacienda at the end of the street.
What's the name of that pub under the arch? What was the name of that pub? At the top.
Was it called the? Well, originally wasn't the one called the Gaiety or something?
I don't remember the Gaiety.
The Gaythorn. There was originally
Gaythorn. That was it.
Gaythorn.
Yeah, and there was a little barber under the bridge as well, if you remember.
It was.
And where home now is was Gasworks. Gasworks.
And I mean, that transformation is incredible, isn't it? In Manchester.
And, I mean, occasionally, because obviously on Little Peter Street as well, as you say, TJ Davison's where, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I assume did you rehearse there as well?
Yeah, we did. Yeah.
And Joy Division, of course.
We did. Yeah.
Buzzcocks had their own room. Joy Division, well, obviously, the Lovell Tears Apart. That's in there.
Yeah.
And I've just been looking at the Kevin Cummings book. I don't know if you've seen it. There's obviously the really famous pictures of Joy Division in that room.
But, wasn't that room actually somebody else's room?
I don't think that was. I think that was one of the ones that you just hired out for the day. That one.
Yeah. It wasn't Joy Division's usual one, I don't think.
No.
Yeah, it was an absolute shithole.
Tip.
You see, the thing is that those buildings were old, obviously old Victorian buildings, brick buildings, really well built, and actually had a kind of built in good acoustics and good sound insulation. Plus, there was nobody living anywhere near them.
Yeah, that's right.
No.
You'd come and go at all hours, and there was nobody.
Yeah. Yeah.
No,
all it needed was a sweeping brush. It would have been all right, wouldn't it?
I think the first person who lived one of the first people who lived down there was Tony Wilson, because he bought a loft apartment more or less opposite the boardwalk. Yeah, he lived on Little Peter Street.
Opposite, I was at Neil.
There was somebody who lived there before him. There was the sort of the gentleman of the road who Tony Davidson hired to open up for him. He found him sleeping in the doorway, and he hired him as like the caretaker. He was sleeping. Yeah. He was well ahead of the curve. He was.
So there was a bit of a history there. But I know the Fall never played, but I remember the Weeds playing. I always thought of the Weeds as a bit of a.
It was Simon, wasn't it? That was Simon Wollstonecroft.
Simon's band. Andrew Berry was a singer.
Andrew Berry, yeah.
Andrew Berry, what a great bloke he was, which still is. But
also, I remember Mark occasionally coming in. I remember there was a New York band called Live Skull.
Oh, yeah.
You remember them?
No, they've been out in my booze of them, Live Skull. I remember them.
Mark. Knew them, and I think him and Bricks came to see them play. So that was about 86 ish. Right.
When did it open in the boardwalk?
As a venue, March I think 86.
Right, and were you involved with it straight away?
I booked the bands on Saturday nights.
Right,
so I booked Live Skull and Pale Fountains Lieback. Yeah. Who were an amazing
Lieback. Oh, blimey.
Lieback, and that was incredible. And all kinds of bands, and that was the first place I put Sonic Youth on.
Right, okay. When they slept on your titular floor,
In fact, they slept on my floor, and then I think they did the boardwalk after that.
I know it's in your book, but for the benefit of the very few of our listeners who haven't read it, so that was the same time you were working at the Hacienda. Were you kind of doing both?
So I started the Saturdays at the Boardwalk in March 86, and I was doing Thursday nights at the Hacienda DJing from May 86.
Was it busy then, the Hacienda 86? I'm trying to think. I mean, I know we've all watched many documentaries, but when did it...
Well, it began... they moved early 86. There was a new manager came on board, a guy called Paul Mason, who'd been at Rock City in Nottingham. He had a much more commercial sense of how to get things done in a club than previously anyone involved in management previously there. And he said, well, the first thing is you keep putting on these gigs, and every time you put on a gig, you have to hire in a PA, you have to pay the bands, feed them, etc., and not enough people are generally interested in the bands you're putting on to make it pay. So that's why you're losing money. And he started doing DJ only nights at Rock City. So he said, well, what we could do is move away from live music and put more DJs on. And it wasn't a move that they made to kind of, you know, create a new zeitgeist. It was a move.
Of course, yeah.
They would lose money. And they knew they could pay me, they paid me 40 quid to do 9 till 2 on a Thursday night.
And 1986, it's not bad.
It's not bad, no.
It wasn't bad in 1986, I would have thought.
I was signing on.
Working for a living.
I was signing on at the same time, and so it all, you know.
We'll say that.
Yeah, yeah. The statute of limitations has gone. They're not going to go after him for his benefits.
They've come after me a few times. They've got everything they need now. With HMRC and me, we're all right now. So and there were 500 people at the first night, and they were absolutely overjoyed, because it was far in excess of what they thought. And but obviously 3 years later, 500 would have been a disaster. Because,
I was going to say, 500 people, took a lot of fill in that place, didn't it?
Yeah, it did. And then, but Wilson still, they wanted to close it. And Wilson went on a holiday in the August 86. He went to China. by that time, obviously Mike Pickering was doing Fridays, which was started to do really well as well, Nude Night. And then I started Saturdays with a guy called Dean Johnson. So at that point, there were three weekly club nights, and they were beginning to build. And Wilson and everyone still wanted to actually think about closing the club. It was the nearest they'd ever come, because they got this new guy in, and, you know, it was and they'd moved to DJing, and it was like almost like the last throw of the dice. And it was A-level Thursday when the A-level results came out. All the sixth formers descended on the Hacienda, and it was packed as a result. And the management tracked down Tony in China, which was quite a thing in 1986.
Imagine.
And told him, the Fridays are going really well. And Dave's night sold out last night, and I've got letters from Tony Wilson, bizarrely. It's kind of how he decided he wanted to correspond with me, and he's like, that, you know, that gave us enough hope to think, right, well, we'll give it another year. And obviously by a year on from that, it was the end of 87, and by that time, you know, it was clear that inadvertently they had hit the zeitgeist. But people were really into the idea of going to an old warehouse and hearing DJs play.
I never understood it, me, that day. I mean, you know, no offence, but standing in the warehouse listening to it.
Well, to be honest, at the beginning it was controversial. I remember people would bang on the DJ box door and complain about the music. I mean, even when it was full, there'd be, and I always thought of them as kind of people who'd, been into early factories, say, and hadn't been to the Hacienda for a while, and they were expecting something completely different.
Yeah.
And I remember one guy banging on the door and going, "This is disco music. Quit playing the disco music." And
whatever happened to him?
But, you know, it was a big change, because, you know, as you said earlier, you know, you had the gigs by the birthday party and the Cramps and William Burroughs and the Fall, obviously. Yeah. It was that kind of a place. And suddenly for it to be overrun with people listening to funk and disco and house music, it was a big change, you know. Yeah. And that was even before Ecstasy, you know, it was the big change.
But I mean, it wasn't. I mean, you look at the films of those gigs, and you know, Malcolm used to film them, didn't he? And
yeah,
they're great, but the sound in the actual room in terms of live music was shocking, as was my overriding memory of it.
You're totally right, and that's one reason why I think why the DJing thing worked, because it was just, you know, it was easier to get a good sound, and to be honest, it was why house music sounded so good in there, because it was so minimal. You know, I mean, if you'd had a band with two drummers playing at the Hacienda, the sound bouncing around like that, it would have been pretty unlistenable.
It sounded great on the stage.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was going to say that. It did. The sound from the stage was great, wasn't it? You didn't really know what people were talking about, and they said it sounded awful out front.
And then, to be honest, the DJ box, which was, as you remember, opposite the stage on the balcony, it sounded great there as well. It was just, if you paid your £4.50, you were anywhere else, it wasn't a great experience.
Yeah, so they inadvertently created the festival, didn't they? You know, great for the band, great for the people who work there, shit for the punters, you know. So they sort of invented Glastonbury.
Oh, you're a cynical.
I am. That's terrible. I tell you. The first festival I ever went to was Deeply Veiled.
You know, a lot of people enjoy going to Glastonbury.
I mean, my son's going next year. He's just scored tickets for Glastonbury.
Has he got tickets?
Yeah.
Well, he sold out in 10 minutes or something.
10 seconds, yeah. Well, he had three PCs, a laptop, a phone, and a thing going on to buy these three tickets.
But back then, we got the idea. Sorry, you're about to talk about Deeply Veiled.
No, it's all right. Carry on.
Well, I was just going to say that I never saw, there was only a few times I ever saw music outdoors. I mean, I obviously started getting gigs in 1977, and I remember I went to an outdoor gig at Alexandra Palace where the pop group and the Raincoats and the Slits played, and I think that was 79 or 80, maybe 81, I don't know, around then. And then I remember the Fall played a gig for Radio Lancashire, I think, in
Clitheroe, yeah.
And I remember going there, and it was a novelty seeing bands in the open air, because all the bands I'd seen were either in kind of quite sweaty clubs or, you know, or the Apollo or wherever. It's a different...
My first experience of probably seeing a band outdoors was that Alexander Park thing. Buscocks.
That one. The Buscocks.
Which one?
Steel Pulse. Buscocks are Steel Pulse.
Yeah.
That was fantastic, that. What a day that was. Kind of spoiled your... It was all downhill from there for me. It was like my favourite band. The sun was breaking, you know. It was a gorgeous day, and it was fantastic, that gig.
Well, also, it was for a good cause, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. Yeah. Rocking Against Racism, I think it was strange times, weren't they? And never happen again, would it? You'd never get the rise of the far right coming along, would you? We beat them forever.
Yeah, who'd have thought? That's, you know, I mean, I mentioned earlier about bringing politics into the Hacienda documentaries.
Good for you.
But honestly, around that time with Rock Against Racism, which I think was such an incredible force, and I think it, politically, you know, affected a lot of people positively.
Yeah.
You know, even... Mm. I mean, I know even The Fall did a few gigs for Rock Against Racism.
What do you mean, even?
Mark wasn't renowned for, you know, pinning his support on causes of a left-wing nature, was he?
Well, you know, there's a picture in Kevin Cummins' book of Mark with a Rock Against Racism badge on.
That's good. I'm just saying, you know, he wasn't.
I mean, that was the start of, I think that was the start of people in bands being associated with the left, really. I think before then.
Yeah.
I mean, Clapton was the one, wasn't he? He was like sort of directly responsible for the start of Rocky Racism. That speech he did.
Supporting Enoch Powell.
I mean, I don't know if you've read the transcript or heard it, but Christ almighty.
Yeah.
It's horrendous.
Yeah.
But, and I mean, that, the Rolling Stones were kind of not right. They weren't right wing in terms of race, but certainly in terms of taxation and paying your way. I don't think they were particularly left wing either, were they?
No. I think a lot in a way, I mean, there was a bit of overtly political stuff at the end of the 1960s into the 70s.
Yeah.
But I think generally music was seen as almost not apolitical exactly, but, beyond politics, or just like what I always call a rebel yell, where you're yelling, you're not kind of coming up with a blueprint for changing society for the better. So in a way, you're still political, but you're not.
You're not playing up with a small P, as well.
Yeah, exactly. You're not as focused as rock.
I mean, even punk, there was no. If you look at what. I mean, Joe Strummer, I suppose, was vaguely left wing, wasn't he, in a kind of woolly kind of way? But nothing Lydon said you could pin to any the left, right, or anything else, could you?
Yeah. Interviewing Lydon in front of 800 people live, that was an experience.
Oh, yes.
Where was that?
Well, his second autobiography, was it?
That's at Albert Hall in the one in Manchester. In fact, we talked about, he was great. I mean, it was. Again, funnily enough, I had to draw on all my, experience of interviewing Mark to feel confident enough to interview him because, he's, again, quite a difficult personality. Mm-hmm. But we talked, there's a little bit actually on SoundCloud. There's a few bits of interview with him that I did. And he was talking about the NHS and libraries and all this. He didn't give any kind of indication of his sort of Brexity type views. That was a night and a half.
Well, I was going to say, the thing with Lydon, the kind of frustrating thing with him is he'll say some really good stuff and then he'll say something absolutely ridiculous like he supports Trump or whatever. And then he'll say something decent and then he'll say something ridiculous again. He goes around in circles, doesn't he? So you never really know what he actually means, which I presume is the point, isn't it? That's what he's trying to do. You can never really, like Mark in a lot of ways, you never really pin him down to what he actually believes.
No, there's definitely similarities there, aren't there? But at the same time having an air of authenticity about what they do.
Yes, definitely, yeah.
And that is having interviewed so many musicians and others, just absolutely feeling like what you're getting is an authentic person.
Mm-hmm.
Is quite a rarity. You're not getting a mediated version. You're not getting, somebody who's playing a kind of media game in order to sell more records. You're getting the real deal.
You think it's getting rarer, that, Dave?
I don't know. Well, I don't know. I don't interview that many musicians
right,
now.
Okay.
I mean, I think that, like a lot of things change. And I interviewed Jamie XX, and I really like his music. But he didn't seem to have. He wasn't used to people even being interested in him as a person. Whereas that era of the fall were around, especially in the 80s and the music press, people were buying those newspapers to find out more about the person, where did this music come from? Whereas I think the younger musicians are that prepared for that kind of questioning. It's that frustrating thing, the music speaks for itself, which isn't really always true.
You could say there's no real compunction for somebody who makes great records to be an interesting person, is there necessarily?
No. And also whether they're vegetarian or not doesn't really mean whether you should like the music or not.
No. I mean, that's a big thing now, and that's only getting worse, I think. That whole thing of, that ad hominem thing of, I can't listen to this guy's music because he doesn't hold the same views as me. That is... I find it difficult, me. I mean, at a part because we're getting on a bit, but you've got to be able to divorce the artist from the art. I mean, yeah, most of the time. Well, I mean, there's certain. I mean, I know there's lines you can't cross.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think, yeah, there's a red line across which people obviously shouldn't go. I mean, we mentioned the glitter ban before. no one's going to say, oh, yeah, but you can divorce the art from the artist.
Not at all, but what I will say, some of those Gary Glitter records are fantastic, aren't they?
Rock and Roll Part 2 is a great record.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's just an amazing record. But no, yeah. I mean, I'm not, you know, it's not on my playlist, and it never would be again. But yeah.
Well, I tend to find that the musicians in the bands that I like tend to actually be, you know, people who've got opinions more or less like mine, and that's maybe why I like them, because they're communicating to me, and
you tend to find that, don't you? You can you kind of get that from a lot of that from Twitter, don't you? That
you can often instantly recoil from a band, and then 10 months later or a year later, it turns out, you know, that X, Y, Z, and you're like, well, I kind of got that from the music.
Right, okay. Well, yeah. I mean, I think that was the big shot with our friend Mr. Morrissey then, that he people thought he was one thing and he turned out to be another. A lot of people were let down by that, weren't they?
Yeah, I think there's definitely more people, certainly in Britain. I mean, overseas, I don't think they quite get... because they don't understand the politics of Britain so much.
No.
You know, him talking about his support for Tommy Robinson, say, then, telling somebody...
It's not going to mean a lot in Mexico or wherever, is it?
I believe his next album hasn't even got a British release, you know. Wow. It's released around the world, but not in Britain. But I think in Britain there's certainly more... disappointed Morrissey fans than there are Morrissey fans, you know.
Yeah.
I think everyone's pretty aware of what my view of all that is.
Yes, of course.
But it's another one where it's very hard to divorce the art from the artist.
It is. I mean, and without being too trite about this thing, that was something Mark did very well. I think was he never. You know, he could say certain outrageous things, or he could put things in his lyrics, but there was never the naffness of Morrissey. You know, the whole naffness of him coming out and explicitly supporting Tommy Robinson and Britain First and all that. I mean, if nothing else, it's supremely uncool, isn't it?
I like the way you put that. It's true.
Yeah, really. I think that was the skill Mark had. I think he would never pin himself to anything as crass as that. I don't think.
Yeah. So I'm good. Can I ask you a question? I don't know. What do you think, Mark, bless him, as we all knew him, what would he make of, you know, the podcasts and all that? I mean, do you think he'd hate it?
Yeah. He'd hate him. He'd hate the fact we were doing one, I'm sure.
Yeah. someone was talking about this. I mean, it doesn't really work. He thought the words... were his department, which is fine when you're talking about the words to a song, but I think he meant any word that's written about the fall was his department, which is, you know, we would never agree about it. He would think that the bass player and the drummer have no right to discuss the work of the fall.
Yeah.
Because they were only the bass player and the drummer. But fundamentally, we're not going to agree on that one, are we?
No, I mean, yeah, I think, I don't know. I mean, I think that's probably how he would be. The Hanley brothers. But at the same time, I think there was a part of him that, and you can see why, and he's quite at liberty to feel that, where he you know, as I said before, he was a genuinely creative, pioneering artist. Some ways, I think a lot of the stuff that happened around the fall when Mark was around and happens about the fall now is just people being inspired. And I think it would have been a part of him that would have been that would have liked that idea of a legacy and that continuing interest.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. You'd like to think that, wouldn't you? Yeah. No matter what he may say about it in public, that you'd like to think he'd be happy about it in private anyway.
Yeah, I mean, talk about someone like William Burroughs, you know, for me, I know this sounds like a complete, to some people, probably not people listening to a full podcast, but to some people would be like, you know, a completely ridiculous thing to say, but in my eyes, he's like a William Burroughs type character, you know, and the fact that people will, you know, want to talk about, you know, what he did and what the band did and is absolutely what you would expect and want in some ways, I think.
Yeah. I mean, the thing you'd never know is how Mark would look back on The Fall as a finished thing, you know, because it never finished, did it? Mm. So he might have, he might have got quite, you know, if he'd split the band, if the band had finished in 2016 and he carried on, he might have looked back on it in a different way and kind of, you know, warmly. But he was always about the next thing. So he was always going to treat people who look back in with some kind of contempt because it wasn't what he was about. No. And you can't, unfortunately, but with The Fall, you can't do anything but look back now, can you?
And I think to take us back to where we started, I mean, I think that would be a good example to set for Mr. Hook and the Hacienda. Do you know what I mean? I think let's just, well, as William Burroughs said, time to forget a dead empire and build a living republic.
We've got to end it there, David. That's going to be the last line. Really?
You're welcome to it. You're welcome to it.
Thank you. I'm having that. Thanks so much for joining us. That was really good. Really great to speak to you.
Love that.
Nice one. Yeah. Thank you for having me. Take care. No,
it was a pleasure. Enjoy Paris.
Thank you.
Yes.
Yeah.
And how long are you there?
I've got I'm halfway through a month-long stay, so I've got another 2 weeks.
What's the weather like?
It's always the same, more or less the same as Manchester, to be honest, but just with better food.
Right. Okay, Dave, I'll let you go.
Right. See you later. Bye.
Speak to you soon.
Thanks a lot. Bye.
Thanks for joining us for episode 5 of series 3 of Old Brother. The next regular episode will be released in 3 weeks rather than usual 2, thanks to the festivities. But if you're all on the nice list, we'll hopefully get a Christmas special out on the 25th as well. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Old Brother Show, where you'll find links to our Spotify playlist. Or why not subscribe via iTunes, Stitcher or RSS, so you'll be all set for the rest of series 3. You can give us a rating on iTunes, subscribe on YouTube, or just tell your friends if you fancy it too. For further reading, me and Steve's books about The Fall, The Big Midweek and Our Bleeding Guests, are available from Root Publishers and all good bookstores. They make marvellous Christmas presents, not least because they're easy to wrap. Hope to speak to you all again soon, and remember, if you're driving, take your car. Ta-da!